Good morning, everybody. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. In this hour, we're looking at the Baltimore mayoral race and other things that came out of the polls, the statewide race, the interesting poll that came out of the city paper, the Baltimore Sun this morning, again, in the series of polls they're putting out on attitudes around the state and the city. About Freddie Gray, the trial, police, and more. And this is really very telling about, I think, a political divide in our world and what that says about who we are as a state. So we're looking at all that this hour. And before we jump into it with our guests, we want to introduce you all to Steve Robbie, who is the founder and president of Opinion Works, the firm that conducted the Baltimore Sun University of Baltimore poll. Be joining us here for the first part of our program. Steve, welcome. Good to have you with us. Hi, Steve, you there?
I am here.
Okay, good. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
So talk about a bit about the poll here. Someone's already tweeting me and saying, how does this poll work when only 398 likely Baltimore Democrats were polled? How does that tell us anything?
Sure. Well, you know, polling is a scientific enterprise through the principles of random sampling. We interview people that are distributed across the electorate and can draw judgments. And, of course, the proof in the pudding is election day, and pollsters are sometimes wrong, but, you know, very often we're very, very close. And so this random sampling technique is good and it's accurate. I think in the city, we're looking at a primary that is probably fairly low turnout. It's going to be in April, and that's not a time when people are used to voting. And so it's going to be, people drawn out by candidates, people drawn out of concern about events in the city, but it's not going to be a presidential general election type mandate of an election. So that, therefore, our methodology's got to be very careful and very tight. And we start with the voter file, and we select voters that are registered, that have a history of voting in city primaries, and that's the sample that we go out to. So I think our sample is pretty well conducted in that.
And what does it mean when there's this range in polls, as in yours, when they say there's a 4.9% margin of error? How do you calculate that? And it seems different in different polls.
Well, you know, there are some principles which govern random sampling, and they're just mathematical. And so if we do a good job of actually being random in how we select the voters that are being interviewed, and if we do a good job pursuing voters who are harder to reach. You know, some people are more mobile, some people are on the go, and some people are a little less excited about answering their telephone and answering a poll. And so
right.
Those folks can be a little harder to reach, and so it's our job as polling or public opinion research organizations to do a good job of pursuing people at all different levels who are eager and those who are less eager to participate so that we can get a good showing across the poll. That's why we have cell phones in the sample and landlines in the sample.
I was about to ask you that, about the cell phones and landlines, because that's always been this critique, at least from those who are not in the middle of it, of how do you poll people without using cell phones since so many people now are getting rid of their landlines.
Right, and it's getting a little bit easier to do the cell phone sampling. Laws are changing and so on. And so, you know, now you can actually match cell phone numbers to the state voter file, and it makes it possible to call people on their cell phones. Of course, under federal law, we've got to be very respectful when we call cell phones. We can't auto-dial it. We have to ask if people are in a safe place to talk and that sort of a thing. So, you know, all of those principles are applied when we.
How do you account for the fact that people can have a cell phone in New York and be living in Baltimore?
Right, exactly. So, you know, you have this phenomenon now where people are porting their cell phone numbers. In fact, I was just looking at the sample file last night for this poll, and we have area codes in there from Northern Virginia and from, you know, Montgomery County and all sorts of places, because people have brought their cell phones with them from wherever they may have lived before, or maybe their employer supplies the cell phone, you know, that sort of a thing, and the employer may be based in some other locality. So it's based on your billing address, and that's how we can link back the name.
That's fascinating. I think these questions are more technical right now, Steve, just because I think many of our listeners, I'm very curious about how polling has changed, because this is such a new phenomenon in this digital age, about how people communicate and how it may even change more in the future with so many younger people. like my youngest daughter, and students who are in the studio now who probably don't even use that same technology, and everybody is Instagramming and doing other things as opposed to even working on their phones. So it's going to, the whole nature of what you do is going to have to morph and change to keep up with what the technology brings to younger generations.
Well, that's what keeps us up at night, right? You know, so you have to be willing to think about those things. I mean, innovation is in many professions, and not the least of which in ours. And so we do have to think about the technological changes. I think one of the realities of a primary, especially a city primary, is that some of those younger folks that you just talked about really just don't vote that much. And the median age in a primary is much higher than it would be, for example, in the presidential general election next November, when many people come out to vote. And so that's another factor that pollsters have to keep in mind, is as you think about polling in whichever election, you have to think about what the electorate's actually going to look like at the polls, not what people say they're going to do, but really what it does look like.
So let me just talk a bit about the results here before we let you go and go on to our guests here in the studio. I know there's more to come. The Sun has got more to coming out in the next few days. We're looking forward to that and doing a much larger show on Monday about everything that comes through these next few days in those polls. But I'm curious just what the polls showed you and if they're about the interactions happening in our city and state. What stood out for you as you finished this poll?
Well, you know, I mean, you can talk about the mayor's race, and I know you will on the show, I'm sure, and that's proven to be an interesting dynamic. Our poll is showing Sheila Dixon, the former mayor, with not only the highest level of support in the poll at almost 2-1 over her next tier of competitors, but the other significant factor about Sheila Dixon in this poll is that her supporters are much firmer than anybody else. So when we ask the people, are you firm, or could you still change your mind about who you're going to support for mayor? More than half of her vote is firm versus about a third of most of the other candidates in that second tier. And so that doesn't sound like much, but that sort of a base of support is important. So I think, you know, Sheila Dixon, as we have seen, starts off in a strong position for a variety of reasons. Some people have asked, is that just name recognition? But I would suggest no, because I think some of these other candidates that are in the race are very significant citywide entities as well. And so it's more than name recognition. There are other things that are driving that support that I'm sure you'll talk about today. You know, one has to stress about the mayor's race that there really isn't any one candidate, though, that has caught fire or has crystallized this energy that's in the city right now that you know, people are so concerned about these problems. There's a really fractured race, even though Sheila's ahead, and there's a lot of undecided people yet. So there's still a lot of room for that race to move around and churn.
Well, Steve, Robbie, I really appreciate that. This is really fascinating work, having worked from polling before and just looking at this poll. I was so anxious to talk to you to hear more about how this was conducted. And perhaps next week when the rest of the polls come out, we'll have another conversation with you as well, which would be great. Steve Robbie is the founder and president of Opinion Works. He conducted the poll. Their group conducted the poll for the Baltimore Sun and the University of Baltimore. And thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. Look forward to talking again.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
So we are now going to turn to our panel to talk about what was in these polls and turn to you all out there at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And we're joined here in studio Luke Broadwater, reporter for the Baltimore Sun. We cover City Hall and local politics and has been writing about all this. Good to have you back in the studio, Luke.
Thank you.
Charles Ellison joins us, political strategist, hosts now the Ellison Report here on WEAA Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Good to see you in the studio, Charles.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
And welcome to WEAA.
Thank you.
Once again, E.R. Shipp is back in the studio once again, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism here at the Global School of Journalism at Morgan State University. Shipp, good to see you as well.
Good morning.
410-319-8888, your thoughts on this poll and on where this race is. Charles, it's the first time you've been in studio.
Right.
With me. So
I'm always by phone, right?
Good to have you here. So let me start with you.
Right. And this is a great subject. It's a great topic. Very fascinating. Sort of a few takeaways here. One, as far as Sheila Dixon being so far ahead of the rest of the pack, being so far ahead also of her second-place competitor, that's State Senator Catherine Pugh. One, it shows that 20-plus years worth of constituent work paid off for Sheila Dixon. And so Baltimore becomes a city of second chances, if you will. It's more than Charm City. It's the city of second chances in terms of people willing to give her a chance despite kind of the mar on her record. Second thing is, despite all that noise, that was made over the past year or less than a year since the unrest, particularly by youth in Baltimore, at least from based on this poll, and it's still a long way to go because the primary is not until April 26th. It doesn't seem like youth are going to have really a big voting footprint in this particular primary, which is unfortunate. And that's not just Baltimore youth. That's just youth in general.
Right.
You know, youth voter participation has gone down precipitously, particularly over the past few election cycles. So there's no surprise in that. But it's unfortunate and it's sad because youth were kind of at the – they were sort of the genesis for a lot of this unrest and a lot of this energy that we felt here in Baltimore. And sort of the third, for me, last takeaway is definitely a city that's not interested in black male leadership. So this is a poll where, and I'm saying that kind of facetiously, but you know, just as an obvious fact of the poll. I mean, you more than likely are going to have the third black female in a row leading the city. You know, you have Sheila Dixon, then Stephanie Rawlings Blake, and then you possibly might have Sheila Dixon or Catherine Pugh again. But I think that that's something worth pointing out, that this city's really not interested in a lot. There's some qualified where they are perceived as qualified black male politicians in the city. To lead the city. Voters, I mean, the people who were polled, the respondents, not really interested in that.
We'll come back to that point. Mm-hmm. We'll wrestle with that point. Ship?
I don't buy that last part.
I
don't.
That's why I called you next.
Challenge me on that, please.
I don't really see it as a rejection of male leadership necessarily, but in this particular case,
right. The
women have the higher profile. And for those people who like Sheila Dixon, they like Sheila Dixon. It may be that they would have voted for somebody else if she were not in the race. I was first introduced to the cult of Sheila Dixon when I attended a community award ceremony. Yeah. She was late in arriving, and I didn't really know who she was. I was relatively new to Baltimore. And the room went crazy when this woman walked into the room. And then again at Freddie Gray's funeral, she received a standing ovation.
Right.
When there were other celebrities, I would have considered
and very
celebrities.
Light, quiet applause for the mayor.
Oh, yeah, right? Very quiet for her. And even for people like, I don't know, Harry Belafonte types whose name were mentioned, we're polite. But it was noticeably different when Sheila Dixon's name was announced. So there's this passion for her. That has nothing to do, I think, in this particular case, with rejection of male leadership.
Mm-hmm. And Luke, one of the things about this as well, and folks, do join us. I want to hear what you think about who you'd like for mayor and what this poll says to you, 410-319-8888. And we'll go on to the other polls as well in the course of the conversation, because I think the statewide poll just done is fascinating as well in terms of the racial class political divide in the state and what that says. I want to get into that with everybody here. But it's interesting. The poll actually verifies something that we talked about in this program a while ago when one of the people who wanted to run for mayor had a poll done. Mm-hmm. And that poll showed their internal poll of this person. And it showed that Sheila had 20% unshakable support and 35% who would vote for her under no circumstances whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I think this poll kind of reflected that same thing.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you said she has 25 years or so of constituent services. You're talking about the great groundswell of support for Sheila Dixon. I think a lot of what Sheila is benefiting from is a contrast in styles with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. If you look at the people who favor Sheila Dixon in the poll, those are the people who dislike Rawlings Blake the most, which is interesting because while they were in office, they largely supported each other and had the same policies. But since she left and they've become sort of political enemies, you see this great contrast. And yes, so we asked the question, does her conviction for embezzling the gift cards cause you to be less likely or more likely to vote for her? And 47% of respondents said less likely. So that means fully about a half of the city doesn't want her to be mayor again. But the anti-Sheila Dixon vote is split right now among five or six candidates, and therefore she's leading by a good margin.
I mean, and that is part of the politics of this city. There's no runoff. So if you get 25% of the vote and everything is divided up, then you've won this election.
That's true in a number of major cities, I think, these days. So you're essentially running for that April election, which is gets to your point again, that young people aren't really necessarily going to participate in this. I don't know if they realize that. Somebody needs to get that word to them that you only get April to really have your vote seriously counted in the mayoral race. I've heard a few young people saying that people shouldn't vote anyway, just to protest against the whole system.
Right.
And on one level, I understand that, but then you have to get real and realize that if you don't vote, somebody else is going to vote, and you're going to be stuck with whoever is chosen. So it's better to have some kind of clout. And I think if young people organize some of the Black Lives Matter energy and some of that other energy we're seeing, they can have an effect on this race.
Which we've seen, and I've written about this in The Root and a number of other publications. I haven't seen the political punch yet from the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's unfortunate. Like, we just had an election about a couple of weeks ago in a few key states, like Kentucky, for example. Prime opportunities, states where gubernatorial and state legislative races were where you have significant Black populations, Black Lives Matter could have gone in there, maybe did a test run political punch thing, and they didn't do it. And I'm fearing that this is going to happen with Baltimore too. But it's also part of the system's fault. You know, it's part of a lot of us too in the political business or the political industry for not making that connection between the importance of participating in political process and how those outcomes from political process can directly impact your lives. Because ironically, it's the local state races which directly impact those policy issues that we've been really making a lot of noise about for the past couple of years. Now since Ferguson, right? And so young people really do need it. This is if it's any time to really make rubber meet road, it's now, and particularly in a primary or in an election, a local election like this.
And I think I'm going to go open the phones here, but I think that if you poor people and young people don't vote in large numbers, the last time poor people and young people voted in large numbers was 2008, when Barack Obama had this message of hope that galvanized just people that never voted before and brought them out, which is one of the reasons that the Congress lost, because they got ungalvanized, being disappointed. And why I think a big part of why Larry Hogan won was because those same voters did not come out in this last election. And I think it takes some inspiration and organizing to get that vote to the polls. You know, that's part of the problem, I think.
Yeah. One thing we can learn from Larry Hogan's victory is that the poll that we did at The Sun right before he won showed him trailing by 5%. But
his support was
much, much firmer than Anthony Brown's. And so his people turned out in large numbers where Anthony Brown's didn't. We're seeing a similar thing with Sheila Dixon, where she has the firmest support. So we can expect Sheila Dixon voters right now, if the election were today, to turn out in large numbers where others perhaps wouldn't. That said, Sheila Dixon is leading every age category over 35, but under 35, Nick Mosby is the leading choice. So if he were able to galvanize the youth vote and really get youth to register and turn out, perhaps he has a shot.
That's called putting your money and get out the vote.
Well, his wife has made direct appeals to young people to become more active when she even announced the charges against the police officers last spring. She said, this is now your generation, speaking to younger people. It's your time to get out there and make the world change.
You know, two things here, interesting things. One, we're kind of drawing from this poll and also previous experiences like the last Maryland gubernatorial race, that candidates saying campaign management matters. You got a good candidate, you got a good message, you got a good campaign. Because I could see actually 6 months from the gubernatorial race that Anthony Brown was going to lose and that Hogan was going to win. I remember getting like laughed off a couple of radio shows. They're like, get out of here. It's Democratic state 2-1. I'm telling you, I'm driving through 5-6 counties throughout the state and I'm seeing Hogan signs and bumper stickers and those little crabs with the Maryland flags on them. And it's mostly white people who are driving them in places like Anne Arundel, Howard County. There's a surge going on. So that's one. Secondly, you know, it's just that the primary is on April 26th. It's an off-cycle primary. people tend to think of elections as being on a presidential election day, on that November 3rd or 4th.
That is also a presidential primary that day as well.
Right. This presidential primary is going on. But even then, you know, a presidential primary participation can be rather low. I mean, you really get out your real hardcore faithful coming out. Even on the Republican side, GOP primary participation is about 17%. At least it was in the last presidential cycle. That's very low. That's just your people who are very hardcore active in politics. And so, you know, that's the thing. Like, especially young people don't understand the political calendar, the political process. They don't understand how it works. They're very removed and detached from it. And so they get very frustrated.
Let me open the phones here and come back to the rest of these polls at 410-319-8888. Glendora, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, wow, I'm the first one today.
You are today, yes. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the problem I have is when I saw 389 people or 398 people, whatever the number is,
right.
How do you determine that a person is leading when you've only spoken to that number of people? I just feel that it's misleading when polls are taken and given like that. First of all, my question always is, how do I know that when you ask me something that you put down what I said, whether it's a number or ABC or whatever? I don't know what you put down, and whomever you're representing may be in favor of someone in particular. Who's to say that they don't put down whatever is necessary to make it look like something that it isn't? And the other thing is, too, we never seem to give people credit for being able to think. Just because you're a you have registered for the Democratic Party, who says that you want that person and that you'll vote for that person? Even with Governor Hogan, I have friends, and I include myself, that did not vote for the wouldn't have even thought about voting for the Democratic representative because of who that person was. Are we supposed to think, or are we always supposed to follow what they say is the most popular? You know, we need to teach people to look at certain things. Sheila Dixon is a wonderful person. She has a beautiful personality. But are we voting for people because of their personality? We've got a lot of problems. And some of those problems existed even when Sheila Dixon was in office.
So you said a lot here, Glendora. So let me start with the beginning about the poll.
Sure. Yeah. Obviously, I didn't do the poll. We had the pollster address this issue though at the top of the show, and he said it's a representative sample. You try to get the right age breakdown and race breakdown and geographic breakdown around the city, so you have a random representative sample of the city. Obviously, when you're only polling 400 people and you expect 70,000 people to vote, you can get some variations there. But it should be a good gauge of where we are right now in the race. The second point, I think she raises a good one, is that right now a lot of people are judging this on people's either past performance or what they know about them right now. We've yet to have a single television ad. We've yet to have a single debate. And to my knowledge, no candidate has released any policy papers of any kind. So we can't yet compare them on their visions in any detailed way. So I think there is a lot of fluidity in the race, and there's a lot of chance for people to switch or back a different candidate as this goes forward.
So we can take a very short break. Come right back. Gary and Kenneth, you're the next two callers up, 410-319-8888. We're going to explore this mayor's race with some very specific questions. We're going to look at the Van Hollen ahead of Edwards, which some people were shocked about, though if you look at the money, maybe you shouldn't be so shocked about it. We'll talk about that. But also this latest poll that Sun came out with, to me, is very telling about the divide in the state and what it says to us all. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back, everybody. We're here with all of you at 410-319-8888 and write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. As we look at these polls, we'll be doing it more next week as well, about the polls to come. This is a fascinating series of polls that the Sun has put together, and they're still going to be coming out. We're here with Luke Broadwater, one of the people who writes for The Sun, covers the city and local politics. Charles Ellison is a political strategist, host of The Ellison Report on WEAA, Sunday evenings at 9. E.R. Shipp is journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism in the School of Global Journalism here at Morgan State University, and is, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Gary, you're going to come to your call in just 1 second. I want to hear your thoughts, but on the way there, as we were going to break, we were just talking about, you know, what these polls show us and what they don't. I think Sheila is extremely strong. People always talk about her race. Can she get her vote out? Mm. Will they come out to the polls? Mm. That's an unknown. And how much Mosby, who people see as the young charging candidate here coming up, will be affected by the fact that some people say that he's, because of his wife's position, he shouldn't be mayor. And what role is Pugh and Stokes play in all this? I don't believe Miss Embry out or the others or Warnock or the others were running, but clearly these people are out in front.
Yeah, I mean, 11 points is it's a big lead, but it's still tight when you have like so many months to go. So I mean, I wouldn't count someone like Catherine Pugh out. Catherine Pugh, very sharp,
organizing, raising a lot of money,
and I kind of get a feeling like she may experiment a little bit with like coalition politics. She may need to do that, you know, to kind of offset some of that firm support that Dixon had. Dixon, and we said this during the break, Dixon is taken straight from like the Marion Barry playbook, you know, in terms of forming those deep constituent ties, even though the city population-wise is about, what, 15% over the age of 65?
Right.
That's where she's drawing her firm support from voters who are 60 years of age
vote.
Plus. Who do come, they come out and vote. I mean, that's how I learned to vote, through my grandmother, because growing up in Philadelphia, she take me to the poll, and like it was like clockwork. I mean, she knew when those primaries were coming up, and her friends, and they'd get out there. This is that 60-plus age bracket, and that's when I learned at a very young age. People in that age bracket, they, our elders, they get up and they vote, and they appreciate it, and for a number of reasons, some very deep personal reasons. And so that's probably right, why right. They're going to dominate this primary.
I think that's true. And it also shows that in the city, I think when you – with the poll that came out, and the divide in this town over the same as in D.C., white voters are not voting for Sheila Dixon in mm-hmm. large part,
yeah,
but are voting for Catherine Pugh, who has a lot of mm-hmm. – developed a lot of relationships inside the white business community, and for Elizabeth Embry, the daughter of Bob Embry, which is where all those votes are going.
Emory is also a graduate of Columbia University Law School. Yay, Columbia! I graduate from there too.
Yeah.
I think Catherine Pugh also.
But not a reason to vote for somebody.
Oh, no, not even. But I think Pugh also developed some street cred during the unrest. She was
right.
seen at
she
many of
there.
The rallies. She was out there when a lot of other officials were shying away from mm-hmm. from what was going on. So I think that's going to be good for her. And I've heard her speak at a couple of forums where she talked about her record in Annapolis. So she's been on the correct side when it comes to criminal justice issues and housing issues. So I think she does have a chance at tapping into some of those voters who aren't really keen on Sheila Dixon.
I would suggest that there's a large racial divide between the top two candidates. Sheila Dixon, if you look at support among African Americans, has 33%, and Catherine Pugh, I think, only has about 10%. So it's 3-1 advantage there. Now, Sheila Dixon is running fifth among white people, though, and Catherine Pugh is beating her by 5 points there. So if we could see a large white turnout, would that benefit Catherine Pugh against Sheila Dixon?
Or not Warnock and Embry and mm-hmm. all the other candidates,
right,
too.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And I would suggest that also that Sheila's base right now, according to this poll, is the most likely to turn out in large numbers. She has the older female African-American vote in large numbers, which is the...
And she pulls the vote in Baltimore.
Which is the demographic that has traditionally decided Baltimore's elections.
I could see Dixon maybe in a very subtle, very clever way, maybe painting Pugh as sort of like the establishment candidate, but she has to do it in a very clever way. But that's where Pugh has to be careful in how much support she draws from the city's white voters. You know, particularly if you've got this underswell of grassroots post unrest grassroots support going for Dixon, and then they sort of seeing Pew as, oh, you know what, she's Stephanie Rawlings Blake part two. And that's where I think Pew ought to kind of build up more of that grassroots. Also, I mean, Pew right now as state senator, I mean, she's running a major organization right now. She's the head of it, although she's rotating out, National Black Caucus of State Legislators. She ought to play that up. You know, as far as, you know, hey, listen, I can bring kind of some new energy, new political energy here to the city.
And founder of the School of Design, high school.
Right. But one question I want to throw out there, Mark, maybe to all of you, Pew didn't grow up here. She grew up in Philly. Right. I mean, does that hurt her? Hmm. I'm wondering about that.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I don't know Baltimore politics that
Baltimore can be very parochial, but I don't think
got it.
She's been around a while.
Yeah. It is parochial in some ways. I mean, the fact that Elizabeth Embry announces and the same week she has 7%, because a lot of people remember her dad, who hasn't held office in like decades.
Mm-hmm. Runs the Able Foundation.
Tells you something about the Baltimore voter.
Well, I think people are drawn to – let me go open the phones here. People are drawn to Elizabeth Embry for the same reason they're drawn to Nick Mosby, I think, viscerally, because they're young and trying to come up with different ideas. I mean, that'll be part of the campaign. Whether either one of them posts or wins this election, I think what they add to this election is a youthfulness and ideas and pushing where the city could go, which I do not hear from any – from either, actually, honestly, yet maybe they will come up with it. I've not heard from former Mayor Dixon or Senator Pew or Councilman Stokes really brand new ideas about where to go. And maybe that infusion of ideas, will it work in a city like this without organizing and get out the vote campaign? I don't know, but that's an effect.
Yeah, I haven't really heard new ideas from Mosby either yet. He's young, so I hear you on the youthful part, but I'm not sure that we're hearing any really great new ideas there.
He'll be on the show in about a week or two, so he's coming up on the show soon. So, but when we have a chance to talk to Mr. Mosby, we'll find out about just that. 410-319-8888. Gary, on line two, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Mark, and thank you to your guests. As I listened while waiting to discuss this with you guys, I just wrote a couple notes.
Sure.
One of the things about Sheila Dixon is hood recognition and trust. Someone who would know had told me her downfall was a setup. You know, this was a few hundred dollars in gift certificates, and yet this will be exploited by the folks who are against her and her candidacy. I'm sorry, just a few hundred dollars in gift certificates is not going to dissuade a woman of Sheila Dixon's character. So for me, it involves a conspiracy. And I'm a conspiracy theorist of the highest degree.
Gotcha. Right. And I'm not,
but
so it's okay.
Personally, look, I was just going to say this to you.
Go ahead, go.
I told her a year ago. Year and a half, 2 years ago, I said, I'll work for you for free. Now, I love Catherine, I love Nick, and I love Jill Carter. The vote is sacred, and it is our best nonviolent weapon against these negative forces aligned against us. Catherine Pugh, saw her running down Wabash Avenue at 4:30 in the morning many times, okay? I love Catherine Pugh, but I just simply want to restate to you guys, you know, the only weapon that they have against Sheila Dixon is this couple hundred dollars in gift certificates, and that just ain't going to work. Well, and I'll just take your comments off the air.
Gary, thanks so much. Let's talk about it for a minute. I don't think for people who are going to vote for Sheila Dixon, her conviction means little. And it was, you know, several $500 worth of gift cards and the rest. And people look at that as not that big, but other people look at it as a breaking of the public trust when these gift cards were for poor people and you're taking them for yourself. I think that's more the issue for many people than just the gift cards themselves.
I think that's true. And each time this issue comes up, the Sun and City Paper and others make a point of saying she took from poor families and children. So that's going to be the thing that sticks in the mind of those people who are a little wary of her.
Right.
But I've also heard a lot of people who, like Sheila Dixon, say it was a setup. So they're willing to believe that some forces in City Hall and beyond wanted her out of office because for some reason she was more effective than they wanted her to be.
And I having covered politics in this town for years and years and been involved in political life in this town for longer than that, there was nothing that Sheila was doing. I'm going to use the first name because I've actually known former Mayor Dixon since she was in her 20s. And we worked together in a program for kids who had gotten arrested, and instead of going to jail, they came to us. And she wasn't doing anything that upset the establishment at all in the city that I saw. I mean, it wasn't anything. She wasn't bucking. She was effective as mayor. I mean, she did things and was pushing ideas around homelessness and others and housing. And she was I think she was fairly.
And police community relations.
Police community relations. She was effective, I think, in many ways, and trying to change the O'Malley policies around arrest, even though they continued under her administration for a while. I mean, but I don't think – I can't see anything that she did that really upset.
She was Martin O'Malley's chosen successor. I mean, they were a ticket. They ran together. It wasn't as though she was – upsetting, you're right, the powers that be in the Democratic Party. Many people don't remember, the investigation really began on totally different issues than the gift cards. It had to do with, at first, her sister was working for a company that was getting contracts through the Board of Estimates, and those she never disclosed that she had this familial relationship. Then it morphed into her relationship with this developer who was getting lots of contracts and became her boyfriend at the time and was getting special deals. And then so her home got raided. The state prosecutors came in on all these different accusations of corruption. And eventually the only thing that really stuck in the end was the gift cards. So people remember the gift cards, but other people remember some of the other ethical questions that never made their way into court.
People can make an argument about overzealous state prosecutors just going after her after they couldn't get her anything else.
It was a Republican appointed prosecutor.
So there's that argument as well. So all that fits into this. So that,
And I mean, it's kind of difficult to sort of convict her, I guess, on the personal or political relationships because that's how Baltimore works, right? That's how any major city, that's how politics in any major city
Chicago,
works.
Chicago, I don't care where you
Chicago,
are.
Chicago,
right?
D.C., you know, it's built on relationships. So, I mean, if you want to, I think, you know, maybe that's probably why gift cards was sort of the safe way to prosecute, because then once you open up that can as far as her political relationships, she can easily talk about, well, what about your political relationships and, you know, and how they've benefited, or what family members or friends do you have? Let's talk about the whole city of Baltimore. Right. So in that respect.
I'm going to open the phone to you, then I'm going to switch gears here on us. I'm going to get another call in here before we hit and switch gears. I think that there's a – because there is a lot here to that period. And, you know, I think that, Luke, I'm glad you brought up all the issues that you brought up, because there was a lot of talk then about how once they were into this thing after her, they just wanted to go after her. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the political discussion at that moment as well. 410-319-8888. Kenneth, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning.
All right. And all the tips at sea. Hello. Listen, this is going to be a race about poor people. Okay. Any way you look at it, the people are going to come out. It's going to be a tight race, I predict, between Sheila Dixon. Sheila Dixon has a lot to prove, and I think if she gets a second chance, she will prove this. She was set up to be in, at first, to be in one of the great mayors of this city, but, you know, we make mistakes. And I don't want to go into that because it's not important to me. What's important is now, people, what can we get in the mayor's seat? Who can we get in the mayor's seat that is going to do things for poor people right now? And I think Sheila Dixon is the one that can do it for us. So far as people talk about Marion Barry, Marion Barry got jobs for people. Marion Barry, got homes for people. Marion Barry did good things for people, and people remembered that. So let's not compare that to Sheila Dixon. She is going to be the next mayor, and she'll get my vote, and I, you know, that's the way I stand right now.
All right, Kenneth, we appreciate the call. 410-319-8888. Let me shift gears here for a moment. Look at some of the old polls. I found that the Van Hollen Edwards poll was interesting as well. In terms of, there was a lot there. I mean, the common wisdom was that Don Edwards was ahead of Van Hollen, right?
Right.
And
Yeah. I'm a cynic.
Charles, we just don't see it. I saw that face Charles made. No.
Yeah, I didn't see it when she announced. Yeah.
What do you mean?
I don't. She doesn't have that kind of even as a congresswoman. I live in her district, so that's why I'm like I can kind of sense where this was headed, where this was going to go. I mean, it's based on the demographics of the state. It's based on kind of the post Hogan landscape. It's based on, you know, just how her own constituents feel about her. I mean, there's not just really this big kind of passionate swell of support for Donna Edwards, even in her own congressional district. You know, she's not very popular amongst even her own congressional black caucus colleagues on the Hill. That's why you still see, like, Congressman Cummings still playing or toying with the idea of entering the race. I mean, a lot of that is about her just rubbing folks the wrong way on the Hill. I expected Van Hollen to be ahead.
Well, she's not very well known in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So I think we shouldn't be surprised at her mm-hmm. showing in the polls. She's been spending a lot of time in Baltimore, I understand, trying to work against that.
Right.
But she's got a long way to go.
Yeah, it was surprising to me a little bit because the last polls I had seen, including one that was released by the Edwards campaign, had her ahead. So she was winning. Then we see a bunch of ads run by Van Hollen. I mean, I've been seeing Van Hollen ads nonstop.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And then our poll comes out and shows him well ahead, and he's leading in our poll in every jurisdiction in Maryland except for Prince George's County. So the whole Baltimore region. Now, of course, if Elijah gets in the race,
changes the whole
game over, right?
Let's talk about politics. Let's talk about Elijah Cummings and what he could do here. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting that Elijah has this power in the state of Maryland it was beyond what many people thought he would have, right? But that would be really interesting. I think he's really planning it. I've heard people the other morning, just anecdotally, this means nothing but my anecdotes. That somebody said to me, said, "Well, no, I think Elijah's waiting, and he's going to take on Hogan."
For governor.
I've not heard that.
I heard that from a couple of people. Yeah. That's an interesting analysis, possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there's a popularity about him in terms of the way he has stood up doing Freddie Gray, what he did during the Clinton hearings around Libya.
But that's still the older demographic, though. I don't really see younger people seeing Elijah Cummings as their guy. Mm-hmm. He was very present during the unrest. He was out there in the streets. But I think that he's just that older folks like him a lot who remember some of the things he's done in the past. I don't know that it resonates now.
Which is Maryland politics, Maryland machine politics. And it's that older demographic that dominates Maryland machine politics. You know, Cummings obviously sees that. He's going to leverage that. Cummings also see. I mean, there's the race aspect of it all. This is a state where that's 35% African American. It's the most, it has the highest concentration of affluent, or which you would classify as affluent African Americans. Right? They want to see a black statewide elected official, not just a lieutenant governor either. They want to see a black governor. They want to see a black senator.
Right.
They haven't gotten one yet, and they feel like it's their time. And I know that, you know, kind of behind the scenes. That's why, like, a lot of some folks on and off the Hill got a bit salty when Van Hollen said he was going to go for it, because they were like, well, you know, because there are a lot of black elected officials, a lot of folks in the black political class nationally who are like, you know what, Maryland is that state where it's time for this, and that needs to happen now.
I'm going to open the phones here, get our listeners right back in here, because I think that's an interesting dynamic. I'd like to see how this unfolds. In the coming years in this thing. If you remember when Kwesi ran against Ben Cardin, Kwesi mm-hmm. Mfumi ran against Ben mm-hmm. Cardin, he ran a really strong campaign with no money and mostly just him driving around the state in the car mm-hmm. with his driver. He pushed that envelope, and then if he had more money, he'd have a much greater threat to Cardin than he was, but he didn't have any money mm-hmm. in his campaign. So I mean, I think that dynamic is real, and I think that dynamic doesn't fit just in the black community. I think there are a lot of people in Montgomery County and white voters in Baltimore City especially who would also want to see that representation. Mm-hmm. So there's a dynamic here, I think, that hasn't played out yet.
I think one of the things that might be holding Elijah back is his gig right now is pretty sweet, right? He, you know, he was going to win every election as long as he wants that seat.
Yes.
He's on all these high-profile committees. I mean, he's getting to spar on national television all the time.
With Republicans,
yeah,
right.
In front of Hillary Clinton on, like, the biggest issues in the country. If he gets in the Senate, although it's a more prestigious job, he'll be at the bottom of the ladder again, won't be on all these committees. And will that really be a better move for him personally?
We'll keep watching this. If he doesn't want to send, we'll watch what happens maybe in the governor's race.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard that.
I haven't heard either.
I can see that, though.
I can. Until a couple people mentioned to me in the last week at different gatherings, went, I've never thought about that idea.
Well, if you've heard it on the Steiner Show, it must be so.
410-319-8888. We're going to Barry, line one. You're on the air. Hi, Barry. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mark, and hi. Hello to you guys. I wanted to draw something that I'm glad you brought up, and that's about the money in Baltimore City politics.
Yes, yes, go ahead.
There's been a huge, huge investment, of course, around the harbor, and that money mostly came from outside of the city. Which candidate do you think is going to attract the folks that back all of that money down the harbor just to keep their vested interests at the top of the list, versus the candidates that are making at least promises to do stuff in the neighborhoods that have never been fulfilled?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Generally, people do like to bet on front runners or bet on winners, but I can see members, especially of the white business community, having a lot of reluctance giving any money to Sheila Dixon. Mm-hmm. Nick Mosby has the powerful fundraiser Colleen Martin Lauer, who has Governor O'Malley, used to represent Rawlings Blake, has Van Hollen, et cetera. And I can see her getting a lot of money for Nick Mosby. And Catherine Pugh has proved herself to be a pretty strong fundraiser in the past. And Carl Stokes, we all know, has a lot of financial support from Peter Angelos. So I think a lot of them have their own funding streams. But I really don't know how this fundraising is going to go. I can't wait to see the first report in January.
It's very hard to say. It can make a difference, obviously, and I think that's a part and parcel of part of the problems with our politics anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, for real.
You know, is that flow?
But I will point out, Larry Hogan was out fundraised 5-1 by Anthony Brown, and Marilyn Mosby was out fundraised 4-1 by Greg Bernstein, and both of them won. So money isn't everything.
Yeah, money's not everything. And, you know, we're seeing, especially on a national scale, we're seeing blue-collar voters, or those working-class voters, or less college-educated voters, those voters who don't have money to put, you know, to dump into somebody's coffers, kind of dominating the voices, the rhetoric around an election.
410-319-8888. Leo, welcome to the program.
Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows.
All of my friends. How you doing?
Very well, man.
Hey, Leo.
Well, I got to tell you that I heard your remarks about Quaisi running against Ben Cardin back in the day. Well, Quaisi wasn't serious about that race.
He
wasn't. He kept talking about how wonderful Ben Cardin was. I kept scratching my head to say, oh, we're friends, we love each other. Man, try to win the race and stop jiving. Quaisi is a machine Democrat, as is Elijah Cummings. Elijah Cummings is a Martin O'Malley loyalist. And, he would lose his seniority, but he's so loyal, I think he doesn't mind dividing the black vote to bring in Van Hollen. You know, is that a side issue? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, but the black vote's already divided.
Catherine Pugh and Carl Stokes, they've run two or three times before. Why are they running for mayor? They should be grooming other people because they couldn't get the job done. They didn't organize this city to deliver for poor people what poor people need. So they've been they have a dog in the show, and that's to maintain the Democratic political machine. You know, we got to get people in office who are sincerely interested in changing the institution of politics in Baltimore. It ain't easy, but the people who are running, I'm scratching my head on Elijah. I'm telling you now, he's been there. I remember years ago when he was doing something for people. He ain't doing a damn thing for people now, not for poor people. He's not doing what he ought to be doing. He's just kowtowing to the political establishment.
Leo, always good to hear from you. You add some interesting stuff to the debate and discussion. Ship?
One interesting point he made is that we aren't hearing necessarily from fresh new people right. coming into this system. And I think it's because the system is designed to keep people out unless you already have some name recognition, you already have some certain amount of support from the powers that be already. It's hard to get into the race. So everybody is saying that we need new blood. We need new ideas. I think the editorial in The Sun after the release of the first poll was practically begging someone new to step into the race to offer us hope that we don't see in the candidates that we currently have. But where are those people? Who wants to get into this mess?
I will say there are 13 candidates running for mayor, but most of them have such low profiles and haven't done enough high-profile campaign things yet to really make a lot of traction with the voters. So we did see a below 1% support for a couple of people in the poll, but it wasn't enough to really register.
Let's go back. Quick call before we have to end the hour. It looks like I haven't seen the time come on my computer. I can look at the clock and see we're almost out. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Bill real fast, Harford County.
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well.
I'm calling about the politicians, okay? But if anybody, any politician, anybody, commit a crime, I don't care how small, whatever it is, they shouldn't run again. They shouldn't even run again. Because you look at some of the politicians that we had already served time. He's out, but he died. Look at the Nixon group, whatever he did. I mean, all the politicians should be held responsible, just like the citizens. We are the citizens. We pay them a salary. If they commit a crime, they shouldn't run again. They shouldn't run again at all. Their records should be clean, straight, whatever. Whenever the president came here to visit the mayor, Sheila Dixon was not there. He didn't want to speak to Sheila Dixon. Mm. Therefore, all politicians that want to lead the people, they should be right. They should be right, 100%. Their credit, their whatever, their criminal record, all that should be zero. They should be,
All right. We're just about out of time, Bill, but very quickly.
Real quick point on that. Yeah, because you're in a state where the governor just rejected voting rights for felons, right? And here in the largest city in the state,
right.
You've got someone who was convicted for a crime running for mayor. So caller makes an interesting point there.
Though she's legally allowed to run.
Right.
That's important.
Right.
I do remember.
She's not a felon.
Right. Exactly.
It was a misdemeanor. That's
right.
True.
It's a misdemeanor.
Yeah. It's just the optics of it. You know how
it
looks. Yeah.
I do remember. I had forgotten about that. I do remember when Obama came in the middle of the controversy to town and they wouldn't let Sheila up on the stage.
He would not stand with her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had forgotten about that. That was an interesting point the caller brought up. Yeah.
But it's awfully hard to find candidates out there who have no blemishes at all. Mm-hmm. So realistically, we are going to find flawed characters.
This has been a fascinating discussion. Always good to have you on ship. Great to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for being with us once again. Luke, welcome back.
Thank you.
Come back, Mondial Kids. And Charles Ellison.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you're in the house. And don't forget, I listen to Charles Sunday nights here on WEAA at 9 p.m. on the Ellison Board. And, of course, our other guest, Ship, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in residency at Morgan State University, and Luke Broadwater, reporter for The Sun. Don't go away. We come back. We're going to talk to some young people doing interesting things in our town. A little uplifting and important. Stay with us.